Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, class. Tonight's subject comes from a time in American history that scarcely resembles our own. See, among other things, the weather was acting real funny. It hurt the crops. The small farmer was out on his own, not doing too well. The government was so deep in the pockets of Wall Street investment bankers that there was a housing crisis and a mass migration. Yes, a remote time indeed. But not all things are all bad or all good. And at the risk of spinning this into a didactic yarn, let us examine an anthropological subset that occurred as a result of these hard times. So now when you're farming on your share and you lose everything you got, and all you have is your two shoes, if you're lucky, pants and a shirt, the banker didn't ask you to take it off your back as you were walking out the door. Well, then you had to improvise. Find new means of public transportation. And that's just what the hobo did. Short footnote here. To find out about the hobo's rail riding lives, it's good to consult Professor Woody Guthrie. Song Hobo's Lullaby. If you need further instruction on just what a hobo is, their sorts and condition, consult your IWW glossary. I'll give you time. It's right next to Das Kapital. Top shelf. All right. Now, these hobos weren't just rail riding, thieving ne'er-do-wells. Not all of them, at least. And within this culture, they built a system of language, code of ethics and honor, even a hieroglyphic system of writing. Why, to this day, if you live in an older house, somewhere in middle America, somewhere between Oklahoma and California, you can probably go out and look out on the fence post, find out how the previous owner treated people, whether he was a good Christian, an honest man, a plain dealer. Street investor, hedge fund manager, lying sack of shit, as it were. And last but not least, in this little intercourse, it's been good for me. The hobo developed his own mythological structure and system. That is the subject of tonight's song. It comes out of the Hobo Hymnal, page 39.
Praise the Lord.
Given the way things are going, I think we could all use a little old-time religion now, Dennis. Some might stipulate that the place I'm going to sing about right now actually exists. About 6 miles due west of Cimarron, New Mexico. Well, I don't know about that. They wouldn't let me in because the Boy Scouts of America own it. But I'll keep looking. One evening as the sun went down, the jungle fire was burning. Down the track came a hobo hiking. He said, "Boys, I ain't turning. I'm headed for a land far away beyond the crystal fountains. So come with me and we'll go see Big Rock Candy Mountain. Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's bare and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars are all empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees and the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the cops have wooden legs and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth and a hen lays soft boiled eggs. Farmer's trees are full of fruit and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall and the wind don't blow in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks and little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. Ain't no shorthand shovels, no axes, saws, no picks. While I'm going away where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that had been at work, I'll see y'all next coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Radio Free Kansas, a special segment, This Can't Be Happening. And that's right, This Can't Be Happening. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, broadcasting from my 10 acres in North Jefferson County, Kansas. I am so proud to bring on some of the, sounds like a merry band of pranksters coming on, but brothers and sisters, these are people, real journalists. We're going to open up the lines here to six, hopefully this is Dave Lindorf, 6'10". Can you hear me?
Mike, this is John Grant.
Oh, John Grant, this is good. Thank you.
Okay, I'm here.
Open up the other lines, Brother Matthew. My switchboard operator will get it. We'll open them all up and introduce each other.
Great.
By the way, listeners, that was Frank Prophet. Actually, his real name is Brian Newberry. In character from Lawrence, Kansas, just south of us, 30 miles, playing the classic Big Rock Candy Mountain. I think that was written by the same guy that did Hallelujah, I'm a Bum. Mr. Grant, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Where are you at?
Well, I'm calling from outside of Philadelphia. That's where all of us, as you say, merry pranksters are living.
Well, good. Who else is open, Brother Matt?
Am I on?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dave. There's Dave.
Hey, Michael. Yeah, I should say we're all from outside Philadelphia except for Chuck Young, who's from way outside Philadelphia.
Am I on the air or not?
Yeah. You're on.
Oh, okay. Yeah, hi. This is Chuck and or Charles Young, and I'm in New York. Everybody else is Pennsylvania.
Excellent.
Lynn Washington's here.
Right on. Dave?
Hey, guys. So we're all here.
Right. Here we are.
Dave, would you give us a rundown of what's going on, the big news at thiscan'tbehappening.net?
Well, I decided a little while ago that the blog had run its course, and I wanted to open it up and invite a few guys that I have a lot of respect for as journalists to join me as a news collective. And so I talked with all of them. They were all excited about it, so we got together and kicked it off. For me, it's a little bit like one of the high points of my life when I got together with some journalists in L.A. and founded our own, worker-owned newspaper, the L.A. Vanguard. Only it's without all of the, the hassles of paper and print and, carrying newspapers around in the middle of the night to load news racks and, all of that. This way it all just goes up online and we don't have any editors. So it's kind of a journalist's dream, You got the chance to get your story out and no editors to get in the middle of it.
I'm hip, and I dug that. That's why I picked that song to open up. I thought that was appropriate. It's sort of the Big Rock Candy Mountain of journalists. It's a great thing. Listeners, the opening page, the new website's been remodeled, thiscan'tbehappening.net. It looks beautiful, by the way, Dave. Thanks a lot. I like it.
Well, that's owed to Alfredo Lopez, who is a fascinating guy himself. He's a former young lord from back in the day in the 60s who did a stint of journalism himself, 7 Days Magazine and some other places, and then ended up becoming a extremely technologically proficient guy and co-founded a outfit called MayFirst.org, which is a web host for progressive organizations. And he designed the website.
It's huge, too, by the way. Could you, when I was setting up this show, I got three of your books up there. Available listeners, just scroll down at the Blog Talk Radio website for Radio Free Kansas, and you'll see Dave's three books that I could post. I could only post three. You can click them and get them immediately through Amazon. But I was looking around, snooping, because I got a little bit of a investigative journalist nose myself, and I was wondering, do any of you other gentlemen have books or things or CDs or something going on that we need to know about? And tell us a little bit about what you guys do, what you've done, too.
Well, I just wrote a 6,000-word article for Rolling Stone that they made me rewrite 6 times and then cut it in half. That's going to be in the next issue of Rolling Stone with the Rolling Stones on the cover. And my article is about Solomon Burke, the old soul singer. Dave promised me that he wouldn't make me rewrite things 6 times and then cut them in half. So I said, I'll write for you, Dave.
listeners again is Charles M. Young, also goes by Chuck. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
This is John Grant. I worked as a newspaper reporter. I do op-eds here in Philadelphia periodically at the Daily News. I work a lot with a group called Veterans for Peace. I'm a Vietnam vet. And, I've written fiction. I've published fiction and, nonfiction in various magazines. The Photo Review here in Philadelphia, things like that.
You did the short review on the thiscan'tbehappening.net site, John. It said that you went back to Vietnam.
I went back in 2001. I came into I was a still photographer for many years. I used to do documentary photography in Central America, Haiti, things like that. And I got a little money, and I decided I always wanted to do film, so I got a video camera and an editing system and decided I wanted to do a film of some sort. So a very good friend of mine, a very seriously wounded Marine, Vietnam veteran, decided to move to Vietnam and live and work for a year. And so I followed him back, made 2 trips back. And I just had an incredibly wonderful time of making a film, you know, running around on motorbikes and Saigon traffic and things like that with a camera and stuff, somebody, you know, on the front of the bike. And did a film called Second Time Around about his experiences there. And, of course, the wonderful thing about vets going back to Vietnam is how well received we are. You know, it still baffles me that American veterans of that terrible war, you know, are so welcomed in Vietnam. You know, it just shows that the war never should have happened, because in 1945, for instance, we were they liked us. We were good friends with the Vietnamese. Why we screwed it up in 30 years of war, we don't know. But anyway, yeah, I did a film, and you know, it's a small documentary film, 80 minutes.
Well, that's a little bit long for me. I mean, that's not small on my books, John.
Well, okay, no. I mean, it's small in the sense it's not, you know, a Hollywood item.
Yeah. Now, I understand you also. I don't know how this works out. 2001. That was after Gulf War One, but then
yeah.
You also went to Iraq. Is that sometime? When was that?
Yeah, I made two trips to Iraq. I made one trip with Global Exchange as a military veterans and families, and we walked around with shirts on that said peace, and in Arabic said peace, and you know, we met not Arthur Bremer. It's the wrong Bremer, but you know, the head of the Green Zone. We met, you know, the Bremer, the guy who ran it. And, you know, we did a tour for about 3 weeks in December of 2003. And soon after that, in 2004, I went back as a cameraman on a documentary film. A friend of mine, David Goodman, is doing a film on military and prostitution. And he wanted to see if there was anything there in Iraq. And, of course, prostitution in Vietnam was epidemic, whereas in Iraq it's very, very rare that you find things like that going on. So we didn't find much, but we spent several weeks actually filming all sorts of things. It was a pretty incredible experience.
Yeah. What a career.
Yeah, that involved, you know, we would land in Amman, Jordan, and take a 12-hour in it, like a big GMC SUV across the desert for 12 hours into Baghdad. It was a pretty incredible trip.
Mr. Washington, Lynn Washington, could you give us a little background on yourself, sir?
Yeah, right. I'm a career journalist. That's the only thing I've done with my career other than work for the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania for a while. I'm a columnist with the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper, and I do some writing, and then the other hat that I wear is a professor at Temple University. I'm a professor in the journalism department, and I'm co-director there of a entity called Philadelphia Neighborhoods. And we send students out into various inner-city neighborhoods, you know, various ethnicities. The only, I guess, commonality is the income. They're working class and lower income, the type of communities that the media normally doesn't cover. And the students are supposed to work in multimedia, so we have them do video and digital photography as well as writing and the animations and graphics, and we post it up on a website called PhiladelphiaNeighborhoods.com. And as things worked out, or have worked out, with all of the retrenchments and cutbacks in the local media, in any given semester, we have more reporters on the street from PhiladelphiaNeighborhoods.com than the two newspapers, the two daily newspapers here, and definitely the television stations and the one all-news radio station.
You know, for a minute, but I was listening to NPR just a few days ago, and there was a expose about one of the newspapers going out of business after it won a Pulitzer Prize for uncovering dirty cops.
That was the Philadelphia Daily News. They won a Pulitzer for an incredible a series of articles, not a series, but a series of articles that pretty much spanned a year about a very corrupt group of cops in Philadelphia.
in corruption in Philadelphia cops, there's another word that goes with that. It's called cyclical. It seems like every 3 to 7 years there's a major, major scandal. And then in between, you know, tying all that together is, you know, just brutality and abuse, and as well as corruption that, you know, doesn't make it to the surface. The paper did, in fact, get the Pulitzer Prize, but the entity that owned that paper, as well as the Philadelphia Inquirer, had gone bankrupt. So there was an auction, and the the people who were owed the money, the debtors, they ended up buying it. So it's up in the air again, what's going to happen with the Daily News. I worked for the Philadelphia Daily News from 79 to 89, and there was always question about how long it was going to last and its longevity. And even back in 79, it was that, well, you only have 6 months, 8 months, maybe another year. So the predictions about the Daily News dying might be a little premature. But the forces look like they're aligned in a dangerous way in terms of closing it, that paper and more strongly now than any time in the past.
Well, who is buying it up? I'm sure I got that wrong, but there was a controversy, I guess, who's buying it up or something. Do you know?
I'm not sure the name, but the owner, a guy named Brian Tierney, who had purchased it under a, you know, corporate name, he wanted to buy it back. He didn't. And the collection of debtors, the persons who were owed the money by Tierney, they ended up buying it for substantially less than what Tierney had initially bought it for. So they got a fire sale.
I've heard the people who bought it described as a hedge fund. I'm not sure. Do you know
anything
about that?
Yeah, something to that.
And that sort of finance types. And I'm a little vague on it myself right now.
Yeah. There's certainly all guys that are just in it for the money. There's not a, you know, media person among them. So it's probably doomsday. I think it's doomsday for the news, at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Daily News is going to go down.
Yeah, not to get too subjective, but it seems to be the general trend in media everywhere in the United States, especially print media, which is my darling. I love the newspaper when I can get it, and a good one. And they're, you know, I was wondering, this is Philadelphia. This is, isn't there, does the name Frank Rizzo ring any bells to you guys?
Oh, my God, Frank.
A very large bell.
How far back is that? I'll show you my age. Who,
well,
that,
70s,
yeah.
80s,
he,
yeah.
Wasn't that sort of a slight pimple on the history of Philadelphia? And then Move, M-O-V-E.
Oh, of course, right.
Listeners, old listeners, you might not be familiar with that, but that was sort of a...
Well, I'm sure we all have stories about Frank Rizzo, but when I came to Philadelphia in 1975 from Florida, he was sort of at his height. He was an ex-police commissioner, police goomba on the street, and he's famous for doing things like going to a formal party with a nightstick in his cummerbund, you know, and that kind of stuff. And he came back from Italy, and he said, you know, they know how to treat criminals over there. He'd say, spacco il capo, break their heads. And this was the kind of larger-than-life character. And so I used to write weekly columns at a local city paper, the Germantown Courier. Sort of every week I'd had a column there, and I'd write against Frank Rizzo. So it was sort of, you know, one of these guys you almost love to hate. You know, he's so larger than life. And,
yeah. Sort of an in-house fascist, like a Daryl
pretty much, right.
Oh, very much a fascist.
He ended up dying of a heart attack while he was trying to make a comeback as mayor.
I think he actually died while he was trying to make a crap. He was
right. Well, literally, he was in the men's room, and it was not a
Frank Rizzo and Elvis.
Yeah.
Dave Lindorf wrote a recent piece on Daryl Gates. It was sort of in the same similar vein, wasn't it, Dave?
Yeah, he was a more slicker version of Rizzo out in L.A. The thing that got me about him, he really had a mentality of that his police force should be basically a military kind of, paramilitary kind of organization, and he really did that. But the other thing he did was he
really stepped up the size and scale of their Red Squad operation that they called Public Disorder Intelligence Division. And, you know, I mentioned my newspaper, The Vanguard. It was a target of that Red Squad, so I got to know it very well. They actually assigned a young undercover cop named Connie Malazzo to join our staff. So hopefully none of us are one of those.
But you probably, there's a little disunity there on the staff already. But you could probably assume that with my with the stellar career I have in Kansas, you might as well assume they're listening, brothers.
So. Well, that means you're doing something good. So
yeah, well, I thank you. Well, this is a great new social medium, and it's really I've turned it into a sort of a powerhouse of a radio show on the internet based out here in Kansas, and they do a lot of so-called VIPs, very important politicians listen to this. Just I think to worry that I might be smearing them on air, but, and I do quite regularly. let's see. Let's get back to you. This can't be happening, Dave. You started this thing. I didn't know it was 2004. When did you start?
Yeah. Well, it started out as a publicity vehicle to let people know about the book I'd written of the same name, This Can't Be Happening, which was a small press and didn't have any distribution. So I just started writing stuff to kind of get people reading, and then, you know, hopefully they would go and look at the book. But it didn't work. But anyway, I started writing and, you know, got more and more people reading it and found that it was a good way to get some stories out, so I just kept doing it. And got up to about, you know, between 10 and 15,000 readers a month, and then it sort of stayed at that level. So I just thought, you know, at some point it's time to open it up to more people to write for it. So and I didn't have any money, so I didn't want to, you know, try to get people to write for nothing, because I hate that, having been a freelancer for 30 years almost, and had that people try to foist that on me. So I thought the way around it was to have us all write for free. <It's a collective.
laughs> Right. I know the feeling. Go ahead.
So we survive on donations, and I hope everybody listening will go to the site and contribute to support it, because what we need to do is get enough money so that we can, you know, back off our day jobs and actually be reporters on the site.
Yeah, that's right, and it's a great thing that you've expanded it to these guys. These guys. It's great. While I was reading these bios on your website, I was thinking, my God, these are cool dudes. And you use the word new journalism, and I think it might be. I think that I'd like to hear run around the table here, the audio table. But what do you think? Let's do the electric Kool-Aid acid test. Not to, to abuse Tom Wolfe as much as
right.
I can. And let's talk about what we think a little bit about what new journalism is today. Gentlemen, go ahead, take your pick, and let's not walk over each other too much, as they say in the CBs. Go ahead. Come on, jump in here. What's new journalism today? Is this what we're doing?
This is John Grant. My feeling is I sort of see myself as covering what I call the bullshit beat.
There you go.
Can I say that on your show? I'm not sure.
Yes, sir.
But,
only the frick word, the F word, is banned on
right.
Blog Talk Radio. As my
but it's the
player.
Idea of the former dean of philosophy at Harvard, Frankfurt, I forget his first name, wrote a book called On Bullshit, and in which he said there's two kinds of dishonesty going on in America. There's liars and there's bullshitters. And that... you know, the latter, like a George Bush or a Ronald Reagan, don't even know what the truth is, so it's simply about power for them. And so I think, you know, we have a lot of that going on, and so we need to get to something authentic. We need to find out really what's going on. And I see, you know, sort of what we're doing, at least what I'm doing, I see in that vein.
Well,
and especially in the issues of war and peace, which, you know, we have rough beats, but that's sort of my beat. I just think, you know, in the way these wars are continuing, to go on no matter what. I mean, you can prance out all the logic, all the reason, all the facts, and, of course, they just still keep going and going and going. I'm just reading something now in 04 that was written by, of all things, the Cato Institute, a conservative, libertarian, right-wing group that wanted to get out of Iraq in by 2005 and has this wonderful logic for doing so. But, you know, it just keeps on going and going and going.
Well, you
no
know,
matter
that's
what.
Something. Yeah, right, right, yeah. John. And that's something that really bothers me out here because a lot of people out here consider the only source of what they considered important and balanced coverage is the National Review Online, or the Cato Institute, or I just finished taping an interview with a guy here in Kansas who operates a think tank type thing called Kansas Policy Institute. Really nice guy, but you know, he's fixated on the state budget, not raising taxes, even if it means laying off half the people in the school systems, the public school system.
Education. And
never mind my brother, the janitor over at the Leavenworth School District, and I was appealing to him to a sense of humanity, much in the vein of Michael Moore's recent Capitalism, a Love Story. I really was trying to push him into a goddamn corner, you know? And this guy, it all boiled down to personal responsibility, and we have it's loggerheads out here, brother. It really is. And the libertarian blend, I have a respect for, a lot of respect. But on the other hand, and when it gets on the ground, it gets nasty, you know.
Absolutely.
And like I said, the new journalism isn't well represented in certain respects by these kind of people, in my opinion. You know. And
Michael, I hear roosters in the background?
Yes, sure. That's the best tradition of the Fighting Cock Flyer, the website, folks, where you'll find all the links to not just my 10-acre farm, but all to the brothers. And we're going to have to change the permalink on the margins of the Fighting Cock Flyer, listeners. You're all familiar. You scroll down the Fighting Cock, and there's the picture of Dave Lindorf and saying, keep this guy working. That's a permalink. You click that, it'll take you right to this can't be happening. But I think I'm going to have to change his picture now. I'm not so sure. Beautiful new website he has. I'm really happy with it. I've been wanting to ask this, if I'm going to. I don't care if you want to. What's the ring about, dude?
It's not a ring. It's a drop of water.
Oh, I wonder what that is. That's cool. Tell me something about that.
I think it has to do with just wearing them down, you know, a drop at a time.
Well, I hope I'm putting a gallon on it. That's good. That's
for waterboarding the ruling class.
Mr. John Grant gave his thing on new journalism. Anyone else want to jump in on new journalism?
Well, the new journalism was actually a literary movement in the late 60s, and all four of us are of a particular age. And I know Dave and I were friends, became friends at the class of 1975 at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. And that class, I think, was particularly idealistic. You know, I mean, our heroes were people like Hunter Thompson and Tom Wolfe and Woodward and Bernstein. But there was, in the late 60s, this really quite revolutionary movement of doing kind of long-form journalism with more the conventions of novel writing and, just in terms of style, you could be as subjective as you wanted. And it was quite controversial at the time because conventional journalists felt quite threatened by it. But in the spirit of the 60s, a lot of publications just opened up and started writing about all these incredible new topics in a new way. And you know, there was the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, but you know, rock and roll was in this absolute renaissance period and stuff, and conventional journalism could not figure it out. And it wasn't until Rolling Stone came along that you could do long form journalism about these musicians that were really defining our lives at the time.
Right.
And you know, the corporate journalism, I mean, it gradually reasserted its control over content and form. You know, I mean, there was this big kind of counter-reaction that started in the 70s and goes on to this day. And, you know, one of the reasons that conventional journalism is dying right now is that it's so completely useless.
Yeah.
And we're all, as working journalists, we are so, you know, ground under the thumb of corporate editors that, you know, that it was going to explode some way. And it did. It turned out, you know, I mean, the internet technology came along and gave us all outlets. And,
right.
You know, most of the best journalism now, most of the best writing is online. And there, I mean, I've discovered, you know, dozens of really wonderful writers who never would have gotten a voice in magazines. You know, like 10, 15 years ago, none of these people would have been allowed in magazines. But now they have these,
right.
You know, tremendous followings online. I mean, I wonder now, you know, when you look at what's happened to a newspaper, like, for example, the Los Angeles Times, which used to be a great newspaper. You could tell it was a writer's newspaper. You would sit down in the morning over your coffee, and you could read great features. And it's not that now. You know, it's just like USA Today or any other lousy newspaper. It's not a writer's newspaper anymore. It's an editor's newspaper, and the New York Times has always been an editor's newspaper. And magazines, as they have evolved, have become much more editors, much more the tool of an editor rather than the way that a writer can really display his talent. And I think what's going on online is very exciting now from an artistic standpoint in journalism.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that little euphemism means a lot to people, listeners. I published a couple of underground rags, that's what they call them. Then I went respectable in county journalism out in Pottawatomie County, Kansas, listeners. And you really do bump. When he says writer's newspaper versus a editor's newspaper, speaking from both, doing it in a small scale on both, that really is a big difference. And I'd hope... The 60s are certainly, I hope that's the true legacy. I wanted to throw something else. Let's see, that was, I think that was Chuck, right?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, all right, Chuck. Lynn, what do you think?
Well, I would, with this new
this
journalism,
is, this is,
I would
this
hope
is
that
Washington
the new
Washington.
Journalism becomes what journalism should have always been. It's kind of a back to the future sort of circumstance.
Uh-huh.
I see journalism as really veering away from its mission, its constitutional mission. I mean, we have this freedom of the press clause in the First Amendment. That wasn't just so we could wrap ourselves up and, you know, say that we have this First Amendment. It meant something. It meant that we were supposed to disseminate the media, news media. We're supposed to disseminate information so people can make informed decisions about their government and also to... hold or serve as a watchdog on government and also on private industry. And the journalism has gotten so far away from that. I mean, if you look at the Society of Professional Journalists, they have an ethics code. This stuff sounds great. I mean, it almost sounds like it was burned on the stones and brought down from the mountain. But it's not happening. I mean, one of the provisions is support the open exchange of views, even views that journalists find repugnant. And the media is just so narrow-focused in terms of the type of views that it puts forth, which is, you know, center to right, I mean, let me just give you a quick example. I mean,
sure.
From the presidential campaign, 2 years ago, up to the current time, and we hear so much about socialism, and all these charges are thrown around. Obama's a socialist. He's a Hitler. He's a fascist. He's this, that, and the other. When was the last time that you actually heard a socialist on TV?
I want to tell you something. Excuse me, Mr. Washington. I want to interrupt you just for a short second.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't. And out here in Kansas, it is rampant. They're calling him a Nazi. They're calling President Obama a Nazi, a socialist. He's a Nazi for Big Brother, government, SWAT teams, black helicopters, you name it. It's ludicrous. It's sick. And I want to tell you, I'm a no-holds-barred type of guy when it comes to Obama. I even, how would I say this? My co producer brother Matthew said, "Go ahead, say it." When I was running a show recently with Dave, with your buddy Dave Lindorf on impeaching Obama, I was really reluctant, but I ran it. I had to run it, and I wanted Dave to make his case on impeaching Obama, because I was with him 100% in the years, the dark years under Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it is a different, you know, you would never know Bush in Kansas. You would never know he was president and doing these same dastardly deeds that President Obama's accused of. You know what I mean, Lynn?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think a lot of the failings in journalism are failings of the journalists as well as their institutions. And that has really hurt us. I mean, that's hurt the credibility of the media, and that has coincided with this whole initiative. Actually, it was a campaign, an onslaught from the right to delegitimize the media, and it's all liberal, and you can't believe it, and whatever.
Right.
And now we're now the business is in a real pickle, and consequently, the society is suffering too.
Well, it's so big journalism is so beholden to the corporations, obviously, and money and that sort of thing on one hand. And on the other hand, many writers, for instance, writing about, the military, for instance, are so absolutely intimidated by the notion of access. In other words, if they lose their access, they lose their meal ticket, and so therefore they're self-censored as to what they say, and I think that happens, a lot, and in our case, we don't have two dimes to stick together, so we don't have to worry about that, and we don't expect much access to the military anyway, so we're sort of liberated in that sense.
Well, and once again, folks, there's a donation. I hope there's still. Matter of fact, Dave, is there a PayPal button on that? This can't be happening still with your new remodel?
There is.
Yeah.
My skills aren't good enough to get it where it should be, but if you scroll down on the right past the author boxes, you'll see the donate button.
Yeah, listeners, do not, don't just buy the books or read Chuck Young and Rolling Stone. Don't just do that. You can throw the money directly at the source of this new news collective at thiscan'tbehappening.net. And I am no shirker when it comes to being a barker at the carnival of new journalism. And I'm telling you straight up, folks, this has got to be done. You've got to support this new collective. This is I think it's good. I'm going to make it, to the best of my ability, the East Coast version, or actually, you should say the Left Coast version, of Counterpunch.
Well, it's actually different from Counterpunch in the sense that...
I'm trying to shake you up. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, weren't we the number one blog yesterday on Counterpunch or something?
Oh, yeah, Counterpunch made us website of the day, but actually it's website of the weekend. So, because they don't change it over the weekend, so we're getting like 3 days of being promoted as the website of the day, which is cool. But the one thing I would say that's different, and this is important because I don't think a lot of people realize this right off, is that the difference between this site and a site like Truth Out or Common Dreams or Counterpunch is that. A little less so for Counterpunch because Alex and Jeff both write pieces for Counterpunch. But this is not an aggregator site. This is not a site that's taking stories from other places and printing them. It's a site that's generating its own reporting, and so it's more of a a newspaper in the sense that 4 days a week there's going to be a new story up here, and it'll be us four plus hopefully a few other people who will want to regularly contribute on a less regular basis. Like Jim Ridgway, who's a terrific journalist, wrote for the Village Voice for years with Alex Coburn and on his own, has said he's going to contribute an article a month, and one of his will be going up on Monday. So that's the real difference. This is a newspaper. You can come to it, you know, during the week and get a new story that you won't see anywhere else, unless it gets picked up later.
Right. And, you know, as a matter of principle, for what it's worth, out in the wild, the outlaw land of the Internet, I, as a matter of principle, only link to articles of sources in order to take them to the website from the source. This is no despairing, you know, but when I see something on Common Dreams, I go to the source for where Common Dreams got it, and I link listeners and readers of the Fighting Cock Fire may not understand that, but I think they understand that's one of my principles, that you should try to take it as close to the writer that it can get. And I think what you're describing, Dave, about an, what do you call it, aggregator
sites. That's what these are. You know, they take articles from elsewhere and just put them on their site for free.
Right, for free.
Alternet is like that. Common Dreams, Truth Out, a bunch of places on the left are really like pirates.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I got a real problem even like with my co-editor on the Fighting Cock Fire, because his Dave Davis is a great guy, but he'll lapse. I call, you're having a mental lapse again, Dave, because he'll send me an article at Alternet that really isn't from Alternet, and that's sort of I'll have to spend the extra 15 minutes digging around where they found it, the guy's real website, and where that article is linked to take him to it. And it drives me goddamn crazy sometimes. And contributing editor Dave Davis and I have had numerous email bitch fests on this whole thing. And I think that's what's going on about. I think, you can't talk enough to me about new journalism, because I'm looking to you guys now. I'm trying to learn. And do. Well, you know, tell me, take this somewhere. I mean, let's go beyond it. So we talked the 60s, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson, dead. Tom Wolfe, Bonfire Vanities, for me, was one of the last time I ever read a book by Tom Wolfe.
Well, Tom Wolfe has always been he's always been a Republican,
yeah,
but
he's... You know, if you don't want to say anything, if you want to say something good about Tom Wolfe, go ahead. But tell him it, go on.
Tom Wolfe is a Republican. He's always been a Republican, but he kind of he's a little bit more out of the libertarian tradition, and he did make a great contribution in just in terms of loosening up how you could say things in traditional newspapers and magazines. I mean, the way that he wrote Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, nobody had seen anything like that before.
That's true.
And when you looked at it, it was revelatory. It was like hearing, you know, the Beatles for the first time. It was like, I didn't know anybody could sound like that, and I didn't know anyone could write like that. And I remember very well being a junior at McAllister College and going down to the record store, as I did every 2 weeks, and buying the fourth anniversary issue of Rolling Stone with with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in it. And I started reading, and after the first couple of paragraphs, I was laughing so hard I fell out of bed. And it was the most brilliant, different thing I had ever seen in my life, and I knew in those years the only thing I wanted to do in college was be a Rolling Stone writer. And it was incredible. It just opened up entire new worlds for me, and that's what art of any kind is supposed to do. And I think, you know, a lot of, you know, just because of the way the corporate system works, magazines and newspapers have lost sight of that. I mean, I don't think it's just a matter of the internet stealing things from traditional corporate news sources. I think the traditional corporate news sources really suck, and they have been becoming gradually more worthless over time, and that has really kind of opened up an alternative. You know, it's opened up this. The internet and in that way, and you know, the internet is a public service now in that sense, and the corporate world is desperately trying to get its thumb back on the internet. You know, they want to have this tiered methods of access and stuff now, so that the corporate news sites get all the hits, and so I hope Obama doesn't allow that, but I would bet that he does.
Well, could you give me some other readings? I'll tell you something. What's going on out here? The little county weeklies. A lot of times you'll have if you're lucky enough to have a daily newspaper in your Kansas county, and there's not very many of them, actually. But they're already moving in on this thing of, they'll give you a teaser paragraph and then click, and you got to buy a year subscription to the paper. And maybe if they're, pardon the abused word, liberal, they might give you a 3-month subscription online you can buy in order to get the full article. So, I mean, maybe that may be the future. I don't know, but it sucks if you're trying to help them out. You know what I mean? If there is some reporter in these little papers that's writing his ass off, and you want to support promote him, you steer him to you link him to that article, and they're going to be, I don't know what the answer is. It's truly an outlaw frontier type thing right now we're in, I think. What do you guys think?
Well, everybody's trying to sustain their lives economically, so, you know, writers and newspapers, everybody, you know, wants, you know, to support themselves. They want to make money at the same time.
I'm going to interrupt you, General. I'm going to stir this up a little bit. On one side, you got McKesney. You got McKesney. I can't remember his name. There's a segment. Mm-hmm. Of journalism today that's talking about federal funding, okay, mm-hmm. because it's such a sad affair. And then on the other end, you got a segment, Rupert Murdoch, Wall Street True. Journal, saying you got to buy the article online for whatever, mm-hmm. 99 cents to read the whole thing. And then you got another section over on the other who says that advertising, I guess Google would be an example, Google mm-hmm. News runs itself on advertising. Now here, everything spends on advertisers, and on my little country weekly here in my county, and I got to throw editor publisher Clark Davis of the Valley Falls Vindicator and publisher of the Oskaloosa Independent. There's only two country weeklies in Jefferson County, Kansas, where we're broadcasting from, and one is the county seat Oskaloosa Independent. The other is the Valley Falls Vindicator, and Mr. Davis owns both of them. The editor of the Independent is separate. But in Valley Falls, I've been wanting to die to find an opening, and I'm going to use this, guys. Here's an example. He prints on an old broadsheet format. I'm talking the old Wall mm-hmm. Street Journal and New York Times, which is a wide paper, wide page. You know, you cover your picnic table with two sheets of it, you know, unfold them and throw it out and cover a newspaper.
Right, you can hide at the breakfast table, you know.
Yeah, it's a big, big layout. And the new young editor, Dennis Sharkey, who came on just a few months ago, told me, he says, well, I'm not used to this because in journalism, he's fresh out of school. They they practice on the, I guess, the New York, the format, the narrow, what I call the narrow format. Hell, we used to call it tabloid format. You know what I'm talking about, guys?
Oh,
yeah. The short newspaper, you know? Mm-hmm. Tabloid. And he says, man, I don't really like this big format. I said, oh, it's like a canvas, paint on it. Use big photographs if you got to fill up space, you know? And Mr. Davis, who's a pro at this, I got to hand it to him. This week's issue, here's an example. He paints with a big brush about hunting dogs, or pointers, retrievers. There's a big picture, several pictures of hunting dogs. But over in the left-hand corner is a four-paragraph quote from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, talking about politicians representing the poor back in the 20s. So it's sort of like, but he is beholden, chained to these goddamn advertisers locally. I mean, if the banker don't like it, the supermarket don't like it, they could jerk his ad. Well, maybe not the supermarket, but some of these other people, well, I'll make my ad a lot smaller. I don't want to pay you that much money. Good. I don't want to tell you I'm pissed off with that editorial you write. Mr. Davis writes a great editorial. It's called The Town Crier, but only about once every 4 months because I know he's afraid of losing advertisers.
Sure.
To get into this goddamn economics on the street level of nickel diming your asses to death, and if you take an unpopular editorial slant against the county judge, the county courthouse, goddamn, you're flirting with financial doom.
Mike, I think what you're illustrating is what's gone wrong nationally, is that if you're in a really small town, it's always been true that a local paper could be subjected to enormous pressure by one or two big advertisers in the town. The famous one is always the car dealers, you know, not wanting to have good stories about, you know, car wrecks that involve problems with the car. But what normally happened in days past was that, you know, the large papers, more national papers, urban papers, national radio networks and stuff were insulated from that kind of pressure because there were so many big advertisers. But now that we've gotten all this concentration that we've gotten, there in any particular sector of industry, there's very few companies that are the key advertisers. And so you're now having the same kind of pressures brought on, and this is even if they don't actually own the papers the way ABC does or NBC, just a large media organization has to worry about threats from the few big advertisers in a sector, and whether it's military, industrial sector, or utility sector, whatever. And so the pressures are enormous on publications now. And so I think the advertising model of real journalism is dead as long as we have this kind of oligopolistic system. So you have to, if you're going to get real journalism, it's going to have to be either, like people are saying, government-sponsored, which works in, say, a British context because they do some decent job of insulating the BBC from what government is in power. It's certainly better than our commercial ones, but it has its own problems. And I think in our country, the government-run things tend to be so corrupted by our corrupt political system. I'm not sure.
Yeah, NPR's gotten worse.
The wall between the business side of a publication and the editorial side of a publication was always a fiction, and now it's not even a fiction. But this process has been going on forever in journalism. The biggest daily newspapers in England were socialist for a long time. I mean, they had circulation in the millions, but they went out of business. Why? Because they couldn't get any advertising from big business, and so they could not survive. And that's what happens now. That's why you have such a narrow range of opinion expressed on the op-ed page of, for example, the Washington Post or the New York Times. I mean, I'm not familiar with these publications in Kansas that you're talking about, but the pressures on the New York Times and the Washington Post are exactly the same as what you're describing there in Kansas. And, you know, I'm very familiar with real estate fights and stuff in New York, and you never get good coverage of the real estate industry in New York City, because the New York Times is so dependent on their advertising. And,
we have a culture that's just so corrupted by basically illusion on all levels, advertising, marketing, you know, special effects and movies. You know, we don't, that the idea of an authentic journalism, you know, becomes hard to sustain. You know, it's a real challenge to actually say something real. And all of the advertising that we're talking about is what this country is sort of based on. Look at our politicians, my God, it's an entire marketing advertising system. You know, we can't get real information about what these people really will do until they're finally elected, and then we find out. You know,
when I was younger and more foolish, I once was narrowed down to either two or three candidates for a Metropolitan General Assignment post at the New York Times, and I got called in by the Metro editor for the interview, and I put on a suit and tie for probably the first time in 5 years, and went in and had a talk with the guy. And at one point he said, "So what do you see as the big story? You know, you'd be looking for your own stories as a general assignment reporter. What do you see as the big story in New York City?" And I said, "Real estate corruption." The interview sort of petered out after that, and I didn't even get a call back after that. And later I was telling this story to a dear friend of mine, recently died, John Hess, who was a New York Times reporter from Cub reporter until he was a correspondent in Paris covering the Paris peace talks and, uh-huh. So on. And I was telling him this story after he'd retired and became a critic of the Times from outside it. And he said, "Oh, well, you finished yourself off right there." He said, "That's the big story that the Times won't touch.
Shut
you were toxic."
Toxic. Yeah, my God, that's the right
word. Dave, I can testify that you're older now, but you're still foolish.
That's true. Emily did the same thing
today. I'm jumping for the fool's dunk cap on this thing. I'll tell you that. I'm out in Kansas and trying to learn and do this kind of stuff out here. And I find myself either writing so cynically, writing essays, and trying to be as cynical as I can, and then I find out that's a fool's folly in a way, because I talk to Dave, who I consider, and frankly, gentlemen, I'm 55, and I don't want to date you gentlemen much, but, you know, I just sort of look up to you guys, and I call Dave Lindorf, you know, crying in my wine glass, and he says, "Mike, you need to write a... You might consider writing a screenplay comedy type thing about your years protecting abortion doctors in Kansas as a private detective." And I sat back and I thought, well, you know, goddamn, I was thinking of writing a series of detective novels or chapters and making it into a book and printing it on my little printing press here on my 10 acres. And hawking it off on the local level, which I've done before. I've done different things for other people.
That's a great idea. You could be like the Kinky Friedman of Kansas or something.
Yeah, but shit, man. Dave had a better idea. I mean, in a way, when you're out here in the trenches, in the conservative world, the Bush world, or Reagan world, take your pick, you get cynical. And the most, for me, the funnest stuff is some sort of satirical humor.
Yeah.
And I think Gore Vidal, I'm going to throw his name out here among you great guys. Mm-hmm. Gore Vidal was talking about he was talking about the colonial days of the American Revolution, and, you know, that's much abused with the Tea Party nowadays. These idiots out here don't have a understanding that every village had several town criers with different printing presses, and they were all they were contending for public opinion, and it's like the brother here earlier said, I forgot which one of you said it, talked about the most of the papers, in early papers in Britain, were popular papers, were socialist. Well, that's mm-hmm. because there was a mass ferment. There was a mm-hmm. ferment. I don't know the word, but there was a social movement of discontent, and there was a sort of a, God, I hate to sound like a goddamn libertarian, but there was a free market contending mm-hmm. for ideas, and I don't know if it's going to be, unless you own your own press.
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting to me as a photographer is the idea that press credentials at things. The city government and even the police department get into designating for press passes and whatnot. Who is a journalist and who is not? In other words, they can restrict you. Whereas you go back to the old days, as you talked about in colonial times, you had one guy with a pen and a pad and a printing press back at the house. And mm-hmm. and that was the journalist. Well, when you're getting into the internet and all these blogs and whatnot, we're sort of harking back to that in a way. So the idea, we don't need no stinking press passes is sort of my mantra in some ways. And so I think things like that are happening. And you talk about this new journalism, the new journalism. Yeah. And as Chuck was, let me hark back while I'm on here. That you mentioned humor, I think it is so important that we, because we can become cynical, that we don't do that and we have a sense of humor that's almost a saving grace. And that this the new journalism, one of the things that it encouraged and allowed in journalism was that sense of humor, that sense of absurdity. And mm-hmm. and I really cherish that. So.
And satire, I think that's...
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Maybe that's why, you think, Mr. Lindorf, Dave, you think that's what's going on with the Jon Stewart show being more popular than the... Well, what do you think?
You're talking to somebody who doesn't watch TV, so I don't know what
Jon Stewart... Well, that and Bill Maher, I think oftentimes, exactly, they as commentary, they are very, very astute because they are satiric and
uh-huh.
they're sharp and they're really powerful in that sense. Yes.
I haven't done the
Keith Olbermann too. I don't think we should leave Keith Olbermann off the list.
Yeah, he comes from the other end of it, but they meet in the middle. Yeah.
Well, he's said some things on TV, particularly during the Bush administration, that I never thought I would ever hear on corporate television.
That's true.
And he has really pushed the line on what is saleable and what is sayable. I mean, at the same time, there are lines that he doesn't cross, and
right.
Once in a while, I disagree with him about something. But I do think he is worthy of respect,
and he comes from. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
And I like what I like what Jon Stewart does too. But there are lines. If you become regular watchers of a show like Jon Stewart or David Letterman, I mean, they are very skilled at knowing where the unsayable lines are,
mm-hmm.
Hopefully on this can't be happening .net, we will cross the unsayable lines.
Well, this can't be happening.net is by no means, guys, I'm going to make you give a hat tip to Dave for trying to do it. Now he's making this bold new change. Hey, Dave Lindorf, goddamn, brother, what a great thing, man. This is a good move. I really am happy.
Let's see how it does.
Exactly.
Well, you tell me what you want. Who are your? Here's a contradiction I want to throw at you. I have a problem with the Kansas Democratic Party because you can't figure out what a Democrat is in Kansas. But in all honesty, I was linking Matt. We're talking Rolling Stone now, Chuck. I would routinely link I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Max Tabibi.
Matt Tybee, you mean?
Oh, right.
Matt Tybee. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was getting flack from the who I would call the staunch Democrats of not doing that, and I'm still sort of bewildered of why. And maybe you can't answer this, but why would someone why would a number of Democrat candidates, Democrats, email me and says, if you continue to link to Max Taibbi, whatever his name, Taibbi, you can't, you know, I'm going to stop, you know, I want my email subscription. And by the way, Mr. Lindorf.
Wait a minute, they were canceling their subscriptions because you were linking to Matt Taibbi?
Yeah. That's
and they weren't canceling your subscription. They weren't canceling your subscription for linking to me. I'm scandalized.
Well, Taibbi does use four-letter words, which has always been, an issue with Rolling Stone. I mean, when I got one of the reasons that I went into magazines instead of newspapers was that I wanted to be able to have a full palette. When I painted a picture, I mean, I wanted to be able to use a four-letter word if it was appropriate.
Right.
Taibbi is very skilled at invective, and he's also remarkably enough to the left of the Democratic Party. I mean, Rolling Stone has traditionally not been that politically radical. I mean, they were McGovern supporters in 1972 and things, but it's basically been with the Democratic Party over the years. I personally kind of gave up on the Democrats and during the Clinton administration. I voted for Nader in 96, and I've been voting for him ever since as a protest vote, and I do not consider myself a Democrat anymore. But Taibbi is another guy who has been saying things that I am astonished that he is in Rolling Stone, actually, that he has been allowed to say more of the truth than is allowed in most publications that take advertising like that. I mean, Rolling Stone has a different advertising base than the New York Times, so they can get away with certain things. But I really like Matt Taibbi. I think he's a great writer, I'm proud that Rolling Stone is publishing him. I mean, his metaphor about Goldman Sachs being a vampire squid shoving its blood funnel anywhere it can find money. that is mentioned in almost everything you read about Goldman Sachs. I mean, that metaphor is going to follow that company around for the rest of its life. And I think that metaphor, as much as anything, forced these Senate hearings. I mean, who wants a vampire squid running the economy, you know?
Right.
And so, I mean, Matt Taibbi and Rolling Stone, I really did a public service there, I think.
Well, he's also in, what is his book, The Great Commotion or whatever it is, he's also pretty critical of the left in some places, you know, especially the far left, 911 truthers and all that kind of stuff. I mean, he ridicules them in a chapter that's pretty harsh.
God.
Well, I don't agree with him about everything, but he was great on Goldman Sachs and Wall Street in general, and he doesn't. I think it ought to be able to. I think people who. I don't know. I wish there was more of a dialogue possible between people who have their own theories about what happened on 9/11 and people who reject those theories, but
absolutely,
it can't be. I mean, people have really cemented themselves into positions and just throw hand grenades at each other.
Exactly, but I mean, I guess what I was saying about him is that he's an equal opportunity satirist, if you will, and you know he'll take on a lot of things.
Well, I think one of the reasons that he can get away with saying what he does about Wall Street is that he doesn't subscribe to anything that is called a conspiracy theory by the corporate press. You know, I mean, he is careful to keep his credentials of respectability that way.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think there are a lot of things about 9/11 that have not been explained, and I mean, I don't know what did happen, but.
The whole regime, and we talk about the bullshit again. The whole regime of secrecy that we have that went on steroids after 9/11. We have no clue what is happening. In fact, this latest Times Square bomber, you know, he's singing like a bird and all this we hear. You know, we have no idea what's really happening. And, you know, they're selectively in a public relations mode telling us what they want about it. But, you know, we really don't know the whole picture, and, you know, we probably never will. And unfortunately, then these sort of narratives are made out of this selection of all this information that they know, and so the public only gets a particular narrative that really doesn't explain things. And so there's just so much lost, and 911 is a grotesque example of that. You know?
We should change the name of the website to "We Don't Know What's Happening."
Yeah, right.
No, that's
is it WTF or something?
It doesn't sound like it has gross potential.
We don't know what.
Well, you
although we'll probably get a lot of letters saying that, though.
I'm sure we will.
All right.
Well, listen, I want to give you another thing. Try to throw another literary hand grenade over your head and lob it, and maybe get a. What do you think we're going now? I mean, now we sort of touched on this—the new frontier of outlaw journalism on the internet—and believe me, everything I've heard so far in the show today has been you're all stellar representatives. If you don't want to find out, answer yes or no, Chuck, on this interrogatory. You're a freelance journalist for the Stone, huh? For Rolling Stone, huh?
I am a pure freelance writer. I won Rolling Stone's college journalism contest in 1975 when I was at the Columbia J School with Dave, and I've had an off and on relationship with them ever since. I mean, I was hired there in 1976, and I was on staff in the late 70s, and which was really a good time to be on staff. There I was writing about all these wonderful rock and roll bands that I worshipped and started developing tinnitus, you know, from going to nightclubs every night. But it was a very exciting time, and punk rock was sort of my beat. And I wrote their cover story about the Sex Pistols, and I knew Sid Vicious. And
well, I was going to ask you about that. Would you gentlemen consider staying on for a little bit? We're going to take a music break, one song, maybe two, and we've got some callers coming up. We only have, now listeners, we have a switchboard with five phone lines coming in, and four of them are taken by stellar gentlemen, and I want you all, would you consider staying on? We'll play a song and bring on, we'll screen one of our callers and bring it. We won't screen the callers in the best tradition of new journalism. Arkansas, East St. Louis. Get back. We'll be back with Lynn Washington, John Grant, Chuck Young, and Dave Lindorf after an old favorite of ours, Graham Parker. One more, folks. Pick it up. Hit it, Matt. Let's see if we get her. There we go. We'll get it. Put a little music on there, brother. We got one more. We'll give the brothers a break on the other end. We'll give that caller 646-716-8652. If you'd like to call in, 646-716-8652. Brother Matt's trying to ring up a song here. And we'll do another one, and we'll have the brother. We'll have John Grant, Lynn Washington. And by the way, we got an email, specific question for Mr. Washington. And an email, by the way, if you want to email your questions in, please feel free at Blue Barn News Central, all one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. And we'll have thank you, listeners, for sending a question for Mr. Washington and for Mr. Young, Chuck Young. We'll get right back to you after we get one. We're going to play one more song and give the brothers on the other end a break. And I want you to enjoy this great conversation with the guys at the new thiscan'tbehappening.net. If you haven't given a donation today to thiscan'tbehappening.net, do so. Now, believe me, micro donations mean a lot. $5, $10, $25, whatever the rooster tells you you can do, please do. Send in some small donations. Micro donations mean a lot on the internet, especially at the websites today. You've listened into an incredible conversation with some, I don't want to sound too bourgeois, but distinguished gentlemen of the press. This is our track. And we're getting ready to. We'll play one more song here in a minute, and we'll get right back to the guests.
Okay, we're just going to make everyone in.
Hurricanes are howling up the Florida coast, leaving the beach towns dead as a ghost. 24 inches of rain in a matter of days. The governor says that it's God's will, that's what he says. Mudslides are running down the hill of the town, knocking the telegraph poles to the ground. Panic in Pennsylvania, that's what they fear. But this has nothing to do with what we're putting in the atmosphere. Say, too much intelligence gets in the way. Yeah, it gets in the way. You know it gets in the way. And if you wanna be happy, be like Forrest Gump every day. Put on your uniform and go to the front. Don't be too sensitive. That's a stunt you don't need when you're stripping the naked and attaching the wires. It's only a frat party, and all Alan's alive. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Stick to the plan. You gotta stick to the plan. I'll keep your finger on the trigger. Yeah, stick to the plan. Well, God, to the president, listen to me. I will advise you on the way it's gonna be. So the president got to his knees and accepted his fate. It's a done deal now. If you've got some objections, too late. Well, meanwhile in the corner there's a drunk on a stool, slurping up ketchup and acting a fool, pretending to fight for the truth, but he ain't getting far.
while they've been cutting the classes. Time is running backwards and the teacher wears glasses. She only sees the back of her head, now what's in front of her eyes? She brought Jesus out of Hock and put Mary on the side with some fries. Meanwhile in the closet there's a funny little man with a Bunsen burner and a pen in his hand, writing his theory and checking his chemistry test. But it's only a theory, so don't place any bets yet. Well, 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 good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Stick to the plan. You gotta stick to the plan. Keep your finger on the trigger. Yeah, stick to the plan. Monkey house, someone got silly, playing hanky-panky with a preacher named Billy, and the TV crews got it all from Bobby Garrett's son. But it didn't make the nightly news, it was too much fun. And inside the airport, every worker wears a turban. At the checkpoint, they're stripping a Suburban, covering all of their clothes and smelling their feet. But they found that the odor of stupidity isn't too sweet. Hey, good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Stick to the plan. You gotta stick to the plan. We'll keep your finger on the trigger. Yep, stick to the plan. If we stick to the plan, good things are coming. If we stick to the plan, stick to the plan. You gotta stick to the plan. We'll keep your finger on the trigger. Yeah, stick to the plan.
There you go. Stick to the Plan by Graham Parker. And before that was On the Bus with Paul Rockets out of East St. Louis. Greg, you're listening to definitely one of the archives, one for the archives, folks. You'll check us out on the Internet Archives or at the Blog Talk Radio Archives. This is Mike Cadell broadcasting for Radio Free Kansas. I am extremely proud, and my buddies that are helping produce this show are extremely proud to have on today the new This Can't Be Happening website. This is a great moment. I think if you missed the first hour, I actually got these Nabobs to talk about new journalism and what it means. I'm going to have the switchboard opened up. You can email us questions. I've got a couple questions coming on right now for Mr. Lynn Washington and one for Chuck Young. And I wanted to make sure you guys are all on air. You guys on? Are you still on?
I'm here. This is Lynn.
I'm here, John.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here. I may lose it soon. My battery's dying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you can call back right back. You got access to a phone, Dave?
I can try to get one.
Call in, because we want to take up the. If you can, we need. I want to put out. Get you. We want your ears and your mouth. From the south or where, from the east, from Philadelphia, for the next half hour. Can we have it? Call back in. I'll have the switchboard operator put you right back on. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Now, Mr. Washington, are you there?
I'm here. Yep.
Okay, here's a star question coming from one of our listeners who emailed us at, by the way, you can email us at bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Mr. Washington, I'm going to take some of the depleting. I'm going to ask the question, but I'm not going to ask it the way that the listener. I'm sorry, listeners. I'm going to do this because I want to be polite to the guest. Okay, but I'm going to try to rephrase it enough that Mr. Washington can answer. Okay? Are you ready, Mr. Washington?
Hey, I'm standing up, or should I be sitting down?
Okay. You might be wanting to sit down, because these people out in Kansas, I don't think they know their manners anymore. Here's the question. I went to This Can't Be Happening, and I saw that you were the one African-American writer on this. On this website, I would like to know what you think of President Obama. That's it.
Oh, no. I think he...
It's yours.
Oh, no. Listen, I have no problem with that. And just because I'm African-American and he happens to be African-American doesn't mean that everything that we have flows the same in terms of opinion. I think he inherited a heck of a mess, but I also think that in terms of what he sold himself as and what he is governing as is totally different, something that you would never get a feel or flavor of if you listen to Fox or even most of the mainstream media, is that there's a lot of dissatisfaction within the African-American community with President Obama. There is a feeling that he has not been addressing the long-standing issues, and this is not something that he should address because he's black. These are things that he should address because he's president and there's some issues out here. Case in point, unemployment in the African-American community officially is listed as around 16%, and that's only of those who are looking for a job or somehow in the system. In places like Philadelphia, there's certain neighborhoods where unemployment is up to 50 and 60%. People are saying that he being the president, should be initiating some sort of public service sort of job since you can get the chronically unemployed employed very quickly. And what has happened is what little job initiatives that have come out of the White House have been public service jobs, these supposedly shovel-ready construction jobs, and these are the jobs mm-hmm. that historically persons in the African-American community have been excluded from because of prejudicial practices in the trade unions. So that's a long way to answer the short question what I think about President Obama.
Oh,
I think in some ways
way.
He's doing a good job. I think in other ways he's doing a horrible job. And one of the things that I thought he was going to do is bring, shut down these wars. And as we see in Afghanistan, he's expanded it. And we can sure use that money here.
Well, right on, brother. But, you know, I'll tell you, I think he's trying to do, I'm sort of positive about President Obama in the sense that he's trying to, I think he's sticking to it. The only thing, I think he's overwhelmed. I mean, my God, when you surround yourself with a cabinet that is, Dave Lindorf pointed out Paul Volcker was in there. I don't know, God, why he said that, but I've been trying to figure that out. But it's a horrible situation. We're facing several peak crises. Look at peak oil. And I'd like to go field that among all you guys after I throw Chuck Young his – I got a star question for Chuck Young. Okay, and my co-producer and brother, he tells me, he says, you know, you're too soft on Obama. But, you know, I think Obama's doing the best he can, surrounded by the financial forces around him. And it's such a mess. It's the country's in such a goddamn mess. I mean, Mr. Washington, help me out. I mean, my God.
Well, it's an incredible mess, and it's really beyond what any one person can do. But I think that I personally think that he needs to be a little stronger. I think there's too much emphasis on this bipartisanship and cooperation, and it's proven that he's not going to get it. So he just needs to go ahead and do what needs to be done. At least do some of the things that he had pledged to do on the campaign trail.
I
think one of his problems is that he has to deal with what we call the powers that be, whether it's military, money, whatever it is. And if he would, take on these powers, he would, in a sense, lose his power. He'd be like Wilson at the end of his term, or so in order to keep his own power, he goes along with too much. That's my feeling.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make that quick point. That's all.
Well, I knew he was lying about everything in the Iowa caucuses, and I did not vote for him on that basis. When he started talking about how he was only opposed to dumb wars and that he thought smart wars were a good idea, I thought, this man is not a peace candidate. And I always thought his rhetoric was empty, and I think as president he is George Bush, who is nonetheless able to speak in complete sentences. I mean, I think he's valuable as a PR person, but I think he's been a rotten president so far.
Holy shit! I can't believe I'm hearing this, but okay, all right, go ahead. Well, I want to throw a follow up on that, not from the emailer, but from myself. Do you think he opens up under extreme political pressure to compromise on offshore drilling? Mm. Dave Lindorf wrote a recent, very pertinent, by the way, once again, if this can't be happening.net, a recent article on the oil spill out there in the Gulf, and he just opened it. He attempted to open up drilling rights around the continental United States. And first, Mr. Lynn Washington, and then I'd appreciate any comments after that about what do you think? This could be turning into a major screw up. But is it his fault? I mean, I don't think so. I mean,
well, no, it's clearly not his fault. I mean, we have clearly agreed from the particular oil company that's behind that platform, and they have a very poor safety record. But this is something that this particular disaster that's going on. I mean, it was just something waiting to happen. I mean, you're drilling into the ocean, the bottom of the ocean, to get oil out, and if something happens, I mean, you're going to have these kind of problems. And I just don't see over the years the country putting enough effort, energy and effort into finding alternatives, and so we're stuck with this situation now. The question is, politically, does he have the savvy to not let this oil dirty him up, as it's going to dirty up the coastline along the Gulf? It's just an absolute mess. And are we still going to hear drill, baby, drill, or are we going to try to get some more action sort of thing? I mean, because, you know, here we have a guy, and I think, you know, I agree with you in terms of what you're saying, that, you know, he's doing a good job in many ways, and I agree with, you know, my colleague that he's doing a very piss-poor job. But here we have a guy who has put forth this notion of clean coal. I mean, please, coal is not clean. It can't be clean. I came from Western Pennsylvania, and, you know, we had strip mining. I mean, there's just incredible ecological degradation out there behind the strip mining, and I've been all throughout Northeast Pennsylvania with, you know, where we have, where we at one point had the deep mine coals. And down in West Virginia, I mean, they're blowing off mountaintops to get at this coal, and nobody thinks that's a good thing. It's, I mean, when you blow up a mountaintop, it's not like after you strip the coal out, you can come back and rebuild it. It's gone forever.
And the miners, those miners got killed at the mine, and then these oil workers were killed on that oil rig. You know, do any of you guys want to jump in on? But I'm serious. This is people are thinking about this stuff, and.
Well, one thing that's interesting about BP is for years, BP has run like full-page ads in the New York Times and things with green flowers and all about their environmental imagery, you know, and television ads in which they have wonderful people talking about very environmental green things. At the same time that they're having a offshore drill unit like that, you know, that's like over a mile deep, in which they have no plan B. They didn't invest money in an alternative if the first level of defense has broken, like it has. There's no fallback, and so it's this disaster of this giant hose from the bowels of the earth coming in. It's exactly the same problem that happened in Katrina, is that the whole infrastructure system of those levees and dikes, was insufficient, and their understanding or their interest, I mean, they're just assumption that, oh, because, you know, we're so sophisticated and so smart, obviously it's going to work. Well, it didn't, and there was no fallback. And unfortunately, the Louisiana Gulf Coast is going to be hit once again. I mean, it is just such a tragedy that it's just unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. I was wondering, I don't know if Dave Lindorf's batteries are still up, but before I throw out a question at Chuck, Mr. Lindorf, what do you think of that article you wrote at thiscan'tbehappening.net, folks? Once again, I mean, that was it. Could you summarize that a little bit, what you posted? Dave, are you there?
Uh-oh.
You may not be there.
Okay,
hello, Dave, are you there?
I think we lost Dave, yeah.
Yeah, he might be
the switchboard operator. I'll put him back on. But I was reading that article about the polar ice shelf, and I'm not sure who's doing the environmental beat. Is that you, John Grant?
I think it's probably Dave, yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, we'll wait. I'll have my buddy run the switchboard again, and we'll see if Dave calls back in.
Are you talking about the article where Dave pointed out that the oil companies spend all this money on propaganda denying global warming in the United States, but at the same time they're planning for global warming by moving into the Arctic and into Greenland because they're planning on all the ice melting so they can sink oil wells there. I mean, it's absolutely astounding. I mean, the word hypocrisy, the word chutzpah doesn't even cover that kind of lying. I mean, I don't know what there aren't words to describe.
Well, bullshit.
But, it's like the Holocaust version of bullshit. I mean, it's not a big enough word.
Well, just the idea that, as this article pointed out, the idea that they're basically, on the conservative angle, they're denying that global warming exists. At the same time, they're banking on it, you know?
Yeah.
Am I in now, guys?
Yeah, you're back on, Dave.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks for covering for me there. the point you could really make there, which I didn't, and which you won't hear anywhere else, is that, you know, you could make an argument that Exxon is saying, hey, we should let them keep doing this global warming stuff and melt more ice because there's a big pile of oil out there in the Arctic we can exploit. You know, I mean, they have a self-interest in global warming.
Yeah, and let me tell you, from my perspective, you know, global warming was real. One of the most fascinating experiences of my life was a couple of years ago when we were in Iceland. And we took a walk on a glacier. It's just mind-boggling. But the point is that we had to drive in from the little road that runs around the coast. We had to go in about 5 miles to get to the glacier to start walking up onto the glacier. And we've only went probably like a half a mile. It seemed like a trek of 27 miles. But anyway, but going in towards the glacier. And seeing the markers that, you know, here's where the glacier was in 1976, here's where it was in 1980, here's where it was in 1995 and 2001 and all the way up. And it's receding quicker, and you have, in talking to people there is the ebb and flows of the glacier, but now it's just like ebbing at such an incredible pace, and it's global warming. And, you know, the claim that it is not happening and, you know, try to create some dispute and, oh, well, these people don't know what they're talking about. It's just absolute foolishness. But that's the power of the dollar.
Well, Mr. Washington, you know what I've been doing lately among the locals out here in Kansas is explain that it's not necessarily global warming because I don't know what's going on, but we had a 40-degree night last night. But I do think it's climate change. The climate is changing. And even the oldsters, the old coffee drinkers up here at the bar, they'll say something's going on, but they won't. But I say, well, why don't you quit being a Republican?
There you go.
Well, there is something going on, and there's another eco disaster going on right now in Nashville, which got an incredible amount of rain in a very short amount of time, and it flooded the downtown, which has never even been flooded before. you know, and all of that is very much predicted by, you know, global warming projections. You know, the heat puts more energy into the atmosphere. There's more water up there when it does come down. You know, I mean, Nashville is a mess right now, and it would be getting a lot more publicity if it weren't for this eco-cataclysm going on in the Gulf. I mean, I think Obama is going to be remembered as the guy who presided over the death of the Caribbean. I mean, this is a you know, they're treating this as a public relations problem, and they're just lying about it up and down, and they're trying to make it seem not that bad. And there's no way that this problem isn't that bad. I mean, it's just, you know, the Gulf Coast of the United States is doomed. I mean,
you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things is that the amount of oil that is shown on these maps, you know, where they keep showing the growing oil
mm-hmm.
spill, is
mm-hmm.
only a fraction of the oil, because they're putting so much dispersant around at the area right where the well is leaking. That oil sinks, and so you don't see it. But it's down mixed with the toxic chemicals they're using as dispersants. It's sitting on the bottom of the ocean and piling up and spreading out. And so we don't even know how much oil is coming out of that thing or what the damage will be, because it's not
flora,
just the wetlands.
At the bottom.
Yep.
Yeah.
Man, oh, man, what a catastrophe. You know, and that's the problem. I was listening to Art Bell. I hate to even say it. That it's stupid Coast to Coast AM, and Greg George Norrie, who runs that show most of the time, he's a nonstop what I would call a climate denier, and he actually had to put on some guests that were scientists last night who were bringing on this stuff data about how this stuff was dooming the Gulf of Mexico to eternal environmental disaster. And I think there might be something what you guys are saying, because George Norrie was backtracking. It's the first time I've ever heard him on Coast to Coast AM, and listeners, you should check it out.
Well, that whole coast makes its living out of the sea, and, you know, with fisheries, you know, and fish and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
I've been on a couple times down there after Katrina, marching down there along the Mobile to New Orleans and things, and in the lower Ninth Ward. And I mean, the extent of this potential disaster is just mind-boggling, and the fact that you know, our oil industry can get away with being so absolutely sloppy and having such absolute levels of profit is just, you know, it's a national crime, and the president should be out flogging that more. But
let me bring this back to the new journalism question and the old journalism question.
Look,
I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I looked at this thing. I don't know anything about oil. I looked at this oil spill, and a couple of things occurred to me right away. One was, what happens if a hurricane comes into the Gulf? The hurricane season starts June 1st. We've had 2 years ago a hurricane in May 7th was the earliest one, named storm. And I haven't read, I Googled hurricane and Gulf oil spill, and there was no article about it. Nobody's asked that question. None of these reporters from the mainstream who go to the press conferences for the with Janet Napolitano or with the president or whoever or the oil executives asks the question, what are you guys going to do if there's a hurricane that comes in? All those booms they put out in front of the levees in front of the bayous and the wetlands are going to be just washed up, you know, 2 miles inshore along with all the oil on the surface. The drills that they're trying to sink, you know, on the side of this thing, those boats are going to have to go to shore if you got a hurricane coming in. The whole thing will fall apart. And, you know, that's just one question. Another question nobody's asked is, how can we have an entire coastline with drilling rigs offshore and they haven't warehoused these booms in warehouses along the coast? I mean, that's the equivalent of having fire hydrants in the city, you know. They haven't done that. They were running around the whole country trying to scour up these booms and ship them to the coast because they didn't have enough. So, you know, this is, and all of this is about regulation. And you say, what about Obama, you know? Well, you know, Obama isn't the one whose administration gave a permit for drilling, deep sea drilling, without having an adequate system for shutting off the oil at the seafloor. That was Cheney, apparently, in that secret meeting that he had with the oil execs right at the beginning of their first term. But Obama has nonetheless said he wants to have more drilling all around the continental, you know, North America. And the question that nobody asked again is, what happens? They want to open up drilling in the Arctic Ocean, but nobody asked the question, what happens if they're drilling in the ice-free summer, and towards the end of the ice-free summer, they have a spill like this, and then the ice closes in. Then all the oil comes up underneath the ice all winter, right? Not 3 months, but like 9 months, until it melts and all the oil's released. How can you possibly drill in that kind of a setting? Nobody asks that question.
Yeah. Dave, you know, the person that I...
You're awful quiet, all of you. That's sort of interesting.
We're stunned.
The person I feel most sorry for in all this mess is Sandra Bullock, because she just moved to New Orleans. You know, she finds out her husband is running around with porn stars, and then she buys a house in New Orleans, and then this oil blowout happens. I mean, she is about as luckless as an Oscar winner can be.
Well, hopefully the poor woman didn't have her funds invested in BP.
a little cosmetic surgery from a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, Sandra Bullock could morph into Sarah Palin.
Yeah, actually, she could play her in the movie.
In the movie.
And that brings me to the star question I got from one of the. Again, you can email your questions. Folks, we're running a little bit out of time. I can't ask all your questions, and thank you for sending them in. But I got a star question for Chuck Young, freelance writer for the Rolling Stone, on to appear regularly at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Mr. Young, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here's a star question. Are you ready?
The star question? It's not just a question. It's a star question.
I mean, there's
something buckle
going
up.
On. I don't know what's going on with the Chuck Young thing, but there's something. Did you really tour with the Sex Pistols, and what do you think is the future of countercultural music? Oh, God, write a book on that, but you only got about 5 minutes. Go ahead.
I was with the Sex Pistols in England in August of 1977. I saw them perform in a small club in Wolverhampton, and I have a poster in my living room that I'm looking at right now that was signed by all four Sex Pistols, including Sid Vicious. There's not any more of those autographs to be had. And the poster actually says it's for the Spots, which is an acronym for Sex Pistols on Tour Secretly. The Sex Pistols were so controversial at the time that they had the tour under assumed names because they were banned everywhere in the United Kingdom. There is no First Amendment in the United Kingdom, and the government, if they really don't like a rock and roll band, they can just say, you can't perform anymore. So they were on tour under these assumed names, and that's when I saw them there. I was also on tour with them in the United States for, I saw them in San Antonio, Dallas, and Baton Rouge in the United States. And then
they didn't get to Kansas? Or?
They didn't play Kansas. It was they played Oklahoma City and then San Francisco after that, and then they broke up. And they've had some reunion shows with Glenn Matlock playing bass, but obviously they can't reunite with Sid because he's gone.
What is the future of countercultural music?
Well, I think That's such a large question. I don't really know. I mean, I suspect that there are all kinds of things happening in the larger picture that are going to, ecologically and economically in the United States, that are going to change music quite a bit. I mean, I do think that we are probably going to enter a period where everything is more localized and everything is more community-based. We're all going to be having to rely on our friends more, and I think that means more music in town, and I hope that means more vibrant local scenes. And, the record business is certainly, that has certainly hit the rocks, but there continue to be, lots of wonderful musicians out there making great music, and music fans have to be a little adventurous and where they look to find new music and stuff, because it's you can't rely on the entertainment conglomerates to make the right selections, but the music's always going to be out there.
We got a 2-minute warning going up. My Brother Matthew just cannot give us 2 minutes. We're talking with Lynn Washington, John Grant, Dave Lindorf, and the infamous, quickly becoming infamous from the questions I got on Gmail, Chuck Young. Right.
He's been infamous longer than that.
Yeah, evidently. I didn't know about that. But I want to thank you all. And on air, for the record, am I going to be allowed to get you guys individually or collectively again on Radio Free Kansas again?
Mike, I want you to save all those infamous questions, and I'll come back on and I answer them for.
Well, and by the way, the explosions going off in the background were from our staff members who were so excited about having some cool journalists for a change coming on and really broadcast on Radio Free Kansas. Those are bottle rockets being shot off in the back of the farm. And it really sort of pissed me off, but I just let them do it because they're running the switchboard, They're happy they didn't have work.
Now,
Michael,
those were
thank
actual
you so
bottle
much for having us on.
Yeah, those were actual bottle rockets being shot off the air in the background.
It wasn't the band the bottle rockets. It was the actual bottle rockets.
Well, we broadcast the bottle rockets today, and we shot, I guess, the staff shot off bottle rockets, too.
Every different kind of bottle rocket on the show today, and everyone at thiscan'tbehappening.net. It's a landmark
right.
Radio.
And there's a PayPal button, and we're signing off now, and thank you, gentlemen, for coming on.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. And well, I'm going to bring you all back on again. Thank you.
Great.
Matt, the co-host, and I thank all you gentlemen, too.
That was the staff. And others. They're shooting the ball on them. Good night. Good afternoon. Have a great Saturday afternoon. Mike Cadell broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, on his 10 acres. This is Radio Free Kansas. Have a great day. Goodbye.
Bye.